What I was going to try to tell you today is a bunch of things. One thing is basically show you some open questions that I think are in this field of avalanches. And I will talk a little bit about magnets first, and then about plasticity second. And the reason why I stuck the magnets in there is because what we're after is figuring out the connections between these systems with avalanches. And we learned a lot from the magnets, and then I'll show you how that carries over to the plasticity and leads to, I think, new questions that we have for the simulations and the experiments. So that's the motivation. And real quick, the work on the magnets was that I'm going to show you today was mostly done with Yang Yu, who graduated this past summer and now has a postdoc in Boston. And it started originally with Jim Sethna, and there's several experiments I'm going to point to. And the work on plasticity was done with Yehuda Ben Zion and Jonathan Yule. And the dislocation dynamics that I'm going to show you were done by Georgios Tsakinas, who is going to be on the job market soon. And he did some very nice work. So if you're looking for an excellent postdoc, he's going to be looking next year. All right. So the first part of the talk, I will give a quick review of the magnets. So I don't want to spend too much time on that, but we need that for the connection to the plasticity. So you're all familiar with magnets. If you have an applied external field and you drive the magnets by sweeping the field up and back, you get hysteresis. And if you look up close, you have these little jumps actually in the hysteresis loop, which are a jerky response to the driving field. And those are usually measured as Barkhausen noise. So you wrap the search coil around your sample, you hook it up to a loudspeaker, and then you hear something like this as you drive up the field, and that's your Barkhausen noise. So basically, you get induction pulses that come from the spins flipping in the direction of the field, and those here you see the voltage as a function of time as you slowly raise the field, and you get these voltage pulses. And the area under each of these pulses corresponds to the number of spins or the change in magnetic moment in such a spin flip avalanche as you raise the field. Now, there are lots of systems that have these avalanches in response to a slow driving force or field. Barkhausen noise and magnets is one example. Another example is acoustic emission. So if you pull on Martin sites, they crackle. There's some very nice work by Jordi Ortin and Eduard Vivas. Then liquids invading porous materials. Bob Halleck and Mike Lilly had some nice experiments where they saw avalanches of pore emptyings as they pumped out liquid helium out of filter materials. And Mark Robbins actually has a very nice theory on these liquids invading porous materials that I'll refer to later. And then dislocation slips and plasticity is just another example. So there were some very nice experiments by Demiduk and others where they sheared crystals and they measured the acoustic emission. And that looks very much like the Barkhausen noise. And we'll come to that later. Another example is slips in granular materials. Bob Berenger has these nice experiments, and Karen Daniels, when they shear a granular material, then you see avalanches in the response of the granular materials. And then finally, earthquakes, of course, is a famous example. So here is the earthquakes as a function of time for 1 year. And these are the size of the earthquakes plotted on this axis. And you see, statistically speaking, it looks quite similar to the Barkhausen noise signal I showed you on the previous slide. So what all these systems have in common is if you do a histogram, if you plot a histogram of the sizes of these avalanches, so here is how often do I get an avalanche as a function of size, you get a broad distribution. And that is often described by a power law over several decades. And the question is there some commonality between these systems, and can we come up with simple models to describe this? So here are, so basically I'm going to show you several simple analytic models that work amazingly well on these systems. And I'm also going to refer to the big open questions in this field. So first of all, can you go beyond universal power laws? And the answer will be yes. For a lot of these systems, you can actually predict universal scaling functions. And we have a bunch of predictions for those that we'd like to compare both to simulations and to experiments. Then the next question is, what is the extent of the underlying universality classes? And we find, in the case of magnets, it's enormous. It even includes equilibrium, which we were very surprised. And then the third question is, what is the relation between crackling noise, these avalanches, and glassiness? So glasses, roughly speaking, are stuck in thermal metastable states. This crackling noise, these avalanches, come from driving a system basically through transitions between metastable states. And the question you may ask is, are these the same? Basically, is there some connection? And so for the Ranafield Ising model, we find that you have the same scaling behavior, basically the same universality class for transitions driving it through ground states and driving it through metastable states in non-equilibrium. I'll come to that later. And then finally, we're looking for experimental tests, especially tuning the disorder. There's not much down there, but also if you don't tune the disorder, there's lots of predictions. Okay, so this slide is the magnet model. So there's basically two models I'm going to talk about in this talk. The magnet model, and then a little later, the plasticity model. So this slide shows you and they're very, very similar, actually. The magnet model is the zero-temperature, non-equilibrium, random field easing model. So you say you have spins that can only point up or down on a lattice, and then you have a Gaussian distribution of random fields, and you have a width to this Gaussian distribution that I'm going to call R. That's a measure of the amount of disorder in the system. And you're all very familiar, I'm sure, with the equilibrium behavior of the system. But we first want to focus on the non-equilibrium behavior, which basically is reflected by driving the system through hysteresis. In non-equilibrium, we just assume as a dynamics that each spin is always aligned with the direction of the local field, which is the applied external field plus the random field, which are supposed to be these green arrows here in the lattice, which are quenched, they're frozen in, and a coupling to the neighboring spins. In the plasticity model later, these random fields are going to be equivalent to sort of local failure thresholds. Yep.
For the real Barkhausen noise and ferromagnets, and is the random field model meant to be a physical description?
Yeah, very good point. Actually, in real magnets, it's more random anisotropies that play a role. But we find that the universality class of this model is so huge that it includes random anisotropies. So we think that the universality class of this should apply to hard magnets. Soft magnets are actually in the universality class of a model that Mark Robbins came up with, which is actually the interface, the pinning model, the random field Ising model, where you only allow spins to flip at the interface. So I'll come to that in a moment. So it depends on whether you have hard or soft magnets. But we are actually still looking for more experimental testing. That's what we think right now is right, but there needs to be more experimental work done to make sure.
Yep. Don't one think of each spin as being the Weiss domain rather than a rare spin?
Yes. So you can think of these as domains. You're absolutely right. So this is really a coarse-grained picture of what's going on. Because we will only focus on universal aspects. So that shouldn't depend on the microscopic details. Yeah, that's a good point. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then we study the system first at zero temperature because we say, for magnetic tapes are designed not to equilibrate at room temperature, right? So the equilibration time scale in magnetic hysteresis is usually huge compared to the experimental time scale. But we do have a theory for what happens when you add temperature, which I think will also, again, later on be useful in the plasticity context. So I think you can learn a lot. I think this is a useful model also for other questions because it's so extremely simple, and you can just try a lot of things with it. All right, so now if you have this model and you start with a very negative field and you slowly raise the field, and then you say each spin flips when this local field flips, then you will get avalanches. One spin flips, and because of the ferromagnetic interaction with the neighbors, it triggers a neighbor, and so on, until you get a cascade of spin flips, which corresponds to sort of a little jump here, which is the equivalent of an earthquake, so to speak, in the plasticity context. And those are the analog of Barkhausen noise in real magnets. All right, so this is the results on that model, on this slide. If you simulate this model at very low disorder, you raise the field, then the system is so clean that eventually you get an avalanche that is unstoppable, that goes through the entire system. That's basically a macroscopic avalanche. On the other hand, so down here, this curve here is supposed to be your Gaussian distribution of random fields. So if this is very narrow, you get these huge system-spanning avalanches. On the other hand, if you make your distribution of random fields wider, so you add disorder to the system, then your hysteresis loop becomes more smooth, because you have basically a competition between interaction and disorder. And so if the disorder is strong, your avalanches tend to be small, so this looks very smooth, and you have no system-spanning avalanche, while if your coupling is much stronger than the disorder, then you get these unstoppable events. And in between these two regimes, there is a critical disorder where you get power law scaling. It's a non-equilibrium phase transition, so you have a hysteresis loop that has power laws here, and the size of this jump basically shrinks down to a point, and you can do scaling collapses and use all these methods from phase transition theory. So for example, down here, we're plotting a histogram, or maybe let me do this first. Here is a phase diagram for this phase transition. So on this axis is disorder. If I raise the field at high disorder, I get a smooth hysteresis loop. If I raise it at low disorder, eventually I hit a point where I get an infinite avalanche. That would be here. And then in between these two regimes, there is the phase transition point with the universal behavior. So here, what we did here is we plotted a histogram of the avalanche size distribution at disorder is higher than the critical value, and sort of we're approaching the critical point from above. And so if you're far away from the critical disorder is about 2.16, so here you're way above, you get a power law with a cutoff, and as you approach the critical point, this cutoff grows, as you expect when you have a diverging correlation length. And then there's these nice Widom scaling methods where you rescale these axes and collapse them all onto one curve. And by the way you rescale these axes, you can read off what these universal exponents are. So, for example, tau plus sigma beta delta would be the power law for this avalanche size distribution, the correct extrapolation to the critical point. And you know, in this case it's 2.03. That would be a prediction for experiments. And then you can also get the exponent associated with how this cutoff grows as you approach the critical point. This is called 1 over sigma here, which is 4.2 in three dimensions. But what I want to point out is not only are these critical exponents universal, but this entire scaling collapse function is also universal. And so this is a definite prediction for experiments. So if you do experiments, noise experiments at different disorders, you should be able to do a scaling collapse and get something just like this if it's in the same universality class. And then one more point, 50% away from the critical point, we still find 2 decades of power law scaling. So in other words, this critical region is enormously big. It's not like an equilibrium where if you go 2% away from TC, you lose the effect. So this, I think, makes this very interesting, that you have these huge scaling regions so that your samples typically have a good chance of falling within this scaling region of the critical point. Okay, so this is the basic phase transition in this model, and disorder is a tuning point, and it's a non-equilibrium phase transition. Okay, just real quick, you know, this was just simulations, but if you really want to understand what's going on, you can also do a renormalization group calculation for this, where you basically define a coarse graining transformation that allows you to look at the system on longer and longer length scales, and fixed points under this coarse graining transformations correspond to critical points where you have power law scaling and your system looks the same on all length scales. So here's a cut through the system with 100 cube spins and 1,000 cube spins, and this is at the critical point, and statistically speaking, they look the same rescaled. So that tells you at the critical point you get this power law scaling behavior where it looks the same on different scales. And this down here is just to show you how these avalanches actually grow as you raise the field. You see that you get nucleation of new domains all the way through the sample. This will be important later. It's still a random fieldizing model, but non-equilibrium. As you raise the basically as you drive it through the hysteresis loop. Yeah, and I'll come to the equilibrium in just a minute. I don't want to dwell too much on this right now. This plot is just to say that if you do your renormalization group calculation, the upper critical dimension is 6, so mean field theory is correct above 6, and you can do a 6 minus epsilon expansion, and the dashed lines are the predictions from the renormalization group. The points with arrow bars are simulations for different exponents. And the agreement is pretty well, so pretty good. So what this is supposed to tell you, yeah, the RG, even though you're expanding around 6 dimensions, seems to work well even down to 3 and 2 dimensions. So we were happy to see that. But we will use the RG later, not so much to get the best values for the exponents, but more in order to determine what other models fall into the same universality class. For comparison with experiments, the simulations is much more useful, I think. So on this axis, we have the exponent value. This goes from 1 to 3.5. It's a fairly small range. And we've plotted several exponents next to each other here for size distribution, distribution of avalanche durations, the power spectra, and so on. And we see the red dots are the predictions from our model, and the blue symbols here are basically from the literature, different Barkhausen noise experiments. And we find that our model falls pretty well within the range of the experiments, wherever there were error bars. So we were quite happy to see that, and we thought, wow, this is great. Until we realized there's another model, the front propagation model. This is the model that Mark Rahman studied, where you just have a single domain wall moving instead of nucleation of avalanches all over. And that does just as good a job of matching the experiments in this range as our model. So exponents alone don't seem to be enough to determine which model is right. We are looking still for experiments where people actually vary the disorder. These were all experiments at a single disorder, and it would be very interesting to see, you know, analysis at different amounts of disorder. So far, there have only been hysteresis loop measurements by Andreas Berger, which looked just like in our simulations, but he wasn't set up to do the noise measurements. So this would be fantastic to see some experiments on it. Yep?
So when you say power spectrum, you're talking about the power spectrum if you look at the time series over the whole sweep, like as you approach the critical point and move away from the critical point?
Yes, we can do that, or so that would be like integrated over H, that's right, or you can also sort of do binning in the force and then do the power spectra for each individually, and then you see how you have a low frequency cutoff that shrinks so that you get an extended range of power law scaling. So you can do both. Yeah, very good. Yep.
Well, good question. In 2D, you do IC model, 2D IC model, IC model. One extension beyond that is XY model in 2D.
Yes.
It gives you the same results, or if you include the long range interaction in XY model, what will happen?
Okay, excellent question. So there is a study by Maren Carter and Rava Silvera. And they did the ON model with the same dynamics, where you apply a magnetic field. And and it falls in the same universality class. And the reason is that it's different in equilibrium. In equilibrium, they're different universality classes. But in non-equilibrium, they're the same because you have an applied magnetic field that already breaks this rotational symmetry. And that's why you end up being in the same universality class. So you don't really have any new symmetries. Adding long-range forces changes things. So that's what I'm going to come to next. Actually, in a couple slides, I'll show you what long-range forces do. They actually change the universality class. So first of all, now back to our big open questions. Can you go beyond universal power laws? Because apparently the power laws don't seem, are not enough information always. And the answer is yes. For example, the average temporal avalanche shape or profile. And this, I really want to emphasize this point because I would love to see in these MD simulations or in plasticity also what people find for a scaling function like this for avalanches in plasticity. And I'll show you here what we get for the magnets and later what we get in the plasticity for predictions for this function. So the idea is this: you have your avalanches. In the case of the magnets, I don't know, can everybody see that here? So this is the voltage, which is really the number of spins flipping per time. In plasticity, this would be the slip velocity as a function of time. Or in earthquakes, it's the moment rate. And so you get avalanches on your time axis that happen if you slowly drive your system that looks sort of like this. And basically the area under these signals, under these pulses here, gives you the size of an avalanche. Now what you can do is you can take all the avalanches of the same duration, take them and average their signals, plot them all on top of each other and average. Then you get a mean temporal profile. That, if you have a power law distribution of avalanche sizes, we would expect, if you do that for all the avalanches that are of a bigger duration, you get a profile which is basically a rescaled version of that, so that you can rescale these profiles on top of each other, and you get a universal shape, right? So basically, what this tells you is the propagation velocity of the avalanche as a function of time. And so in the random field icing model, that's supposed to, we did it in mean field theory. Well, actually, Matthew Kunz did it first. In mean field theory, he got the parabola with Jim Sethna. And then we did it in three dimensions. So over here, you see the collapse of this function in three dimensions, and it looks very close to a parabola. It's not exactly a parabola in three dimensions. And we thought, great, now we have a function that allows us to distinguish between the front propagation model and the nucleation model. And then we can tell experimentalists to do the same. So we basically didn't get what we wanted on both counts. First of all, the front propagation model and the nucleation model have a very similar scaling function also. In this scaling function is the same. It's not the same, almost the same. There's a slight difference, but if you have two noisy data, it may be hard to tell the difference. So for distinguishing between the two models, this doesn't seem to be the ideal case. But we thought at least we have now a prediction for experiments, which has infinitely more information than just a handful set of exponents. So we talked to the experimentalist. Yep.
So this, what's the dynamics here? This is
okay. So
this time is not an obvious, way to map to time for these models.
Well, actually, you can. You can say, I have a spin. You can say each spin flip takes sort of one. Each shell, basically you cut your time axis in time steps, and then you raise your field, and initially an avalanche starts with one spin flipping. And then you check all the neighbors, and so during the next time step, you flip all the spins that now became unstable. And then you check in the next time step who else became unstable. So you get sort of shells for propagating avalanche. And that would give you a time dependence for your propagation.
So we looked for at the random fill IC model at that dynamics.
Right.
And also at a dynamics where the rate of flip depended upon the drive force.
Which, okay.
So you're saying basically the time doesn't depend upon the excess force.
Okay.
But it could.
It could.
And if you do that in the limit of percolation, all the dynamics give the same behavior, because you're dominated by the so-called red bonds in the percolation sense. But
right.
in near the critical point, it's not obvious to me that the dynamics wouldn't matter. Have you looked at different dynamics?
Yes, exactly. So I'll show you. So actually, I think this can be a tool to determine which dynamics is right.
So this dynamics is just every shell flips
right.
in a given time.
Exactly, exactly. So then we went and compared two experiments, and this is what experiments gave. It looks very asymmetric, first of all, and second of all, different experiments don't even give the same thing, even though this is supposed to be universal. So for a number of years, there was a big confusion about this. So these are three different groups, and Spasojevich did it first. He got this. And then Mike Weissman, they got this other curve, and in between there's, or this one is Gianfranco-Durand's curve in Italy. So they were all different, even though the exponents were the same. And the question was why. And then Stefano Zapperi and Gianfranco-Durand, they came up with this idea, well, it could be eddy currents. And eddy currents are, when you have a spin flip, you get eddy currents that have a finite lifetime. So they temporarily prevent, when a spin flips, they temporarily prevent the neighboring spins from also flipping. So it leads to a delay effect, effective delay effect. And then they showed that such a delay effect gives you this asymmetry. However, you know that these eddy currents have only a microscopic lifetime. So you would say, well, this is just a microscopic change to the dynamics. On long link scale, this microscopic delay effect should not change the shape of the function in this case. And you can show that actually as you go to larger and larger avalanches, they did that, then Gianfranco-Durand has a study where they go to larger and larger avalanches, and then you see that indeed the shape becomes more and more symmetric. So it's like approaching the prediction from the model, which is a parabola, or like a parabola. So in other words, we think that this asymmetry is just an effect of sort of this microscopic time scale that comes in, and only if you go to larger avalanches, it goes away. However, what's that? Yes, exactly. That would be perfect. Exactly. So we would love to see something like that. That's right. One comment though, in the models we've also tried introducing inertia, because that was the question. And inertia seems to drive the shape to an asymmetry the other way. So so basically there is, I think this is useful for learning a lot about the dynamics in the system. Then a systematic study would be great. Which perturbations to the dynamics are relevant and which aren't, which are irrelevant on long length scales. Okay, so the next big open question is, what is the extent of the underlying universality class of the simple model? And it turns out it is enormous, much bigger than we expected. First of all, you can use the randomization group to show that using random bonds gives you the same universality class, or changing this to random anisotropies, or even changing the distribution, of course, you know, from Gaussian to anything else that's smooth with a peak gives you the same thing. But you can take it much farther. So for example, you can look at plastic charge density wave depending. That appears to be in the same universality class as this. Or we're thinking there's some nice experiments on high TC superconductors. And basically one can look at stripes in these superconductors, and they may also be described by the same universality class if you drive them by stress. Then you can ask, how can you get out of this universality class? One more point, also equilibrium actually will also fall into the same universality class, as I'll show you a little bit later. But you can ask, what changes can you make to get out of this universality class? And one change you can make is you can add long-range forces, like you were saying. So for example, in magnets, in soft magnets, long-range dipolar forces play a role. So if you add those, basically what happens is you go from this nucleation dynamics to interface propagation dynamics. And that puts you back into Mark Robbins' universal class, where you just have basically here your domain wall, and as you raise the field, this interface moves forward. And there's some very nice studies of many groups, Natterman and Zapari and like all these people, studying this interface depending Wismerization group, and Mark Robbins has studied it, changing the disorder, which is also very interesting. So basically, the change in the dynamics changes your universality class. Now, what we think is, I mean, we have a simple model for several different systems, so which seem to indicate that earthquakes, these simple earthquake models, fall into the same universality class as this interface depending, and then a simple model for plasticity I'll show you falls into the same universality class, which actually I think amounts to the mean field theory of Damien's model. We'll talk about that later. And then we recently have looked at sort of a simple model for avalanches and granular materials, which appears to also be in this universality class. So so this also has an enormously big universality class. Now you might ask, just a comment on the side, you might ask, okay, the exponents didn't seem sufficient to determine which of these two classes you're in. That one scaling function I showed you wasn't enough either. Is there any way I can very quickly tell if I have a system, which of these, do I have nucleation or do I have domain wall depending? Can I just tell that quite quickly? And the answer is, yeah, there's one trick you can try that we sort of learned by making some predictions that turned out not to work for soft magnets. So here is the idea. It's actually quite useful. If you have, so far I've only talked about the saturation hysteresis loop, but often people also look at ring down fields. So where basically when you have a magnetic field as a function of time, you change the amplitude. You ring it down with time, rather than always going through the outer saturation loop. When you do that, you produce these concentric subloops. Now you notice, this is the simulation of our nucleation model. And as you ring down the field, the inner loop looks like a loop at a much higher disorder than the outer loop. And the reason is, as you ring down the field, you leave these clusters of pre-flipped spins which act like added disorder. So this inner loop sort of feels a much more disordered environment than the outer loop. This is an experiment by Andreas Berger where he, with the disk material, he did the same, and qualitatively he sees the same behavior. The inner loop is smooth, while the outer loop has these big jumps. And so we were really happy. We said, great, now we have a way of measuring the transition from loops with a jump to those without a jump by tuning, without having to tune the disorder. We'll just tune the history. So we did it in the simulation. We thought, great, you do the avalanche size distribution, and you'd expect the power law for the outer loop if you do it at the critical disorder or near the critical disorder. And as you ring down your field, you should have a cut up to your avalanche size distribution that shrinks because your loops become more smoothly, just in the same way as if you had added more disorder to the system and moved away from the critical point. And then you can do scaling collapses, and great, you can do this whole analysis without ever having to use a new sample. So we were really happy, and we went to Mike Wiseman with this prediction. We said, just do this, ring down your field, you'll see this change in the cutoff to your avalanche size distribution, and then you can do scaling collapses, and this is great. And he said, sure, we'll do that. And he did it with Andrea Mills, they did, this is their hysteresis loop, and they were ringing down the field, and they measured the Barkhausen noise, and for each subloop, they always found the same cutoff. There was no change. And we thought about this for a while, and then we figured out, of course, he has no change, because his sample was a soft magnet. And in soft magnets, we know you just have a single domain wall that goes back and forward. And you don't have these pockets of preflip spins left in the system that act like added disorder. So you're just moving the same domain wall back and forth, so you get the same statistics of avalanches, no change in effective disorder, and so therefore you get always the same cutoff. So to turn this into a virtue, you can actually use this prescription to determine whether you have interface depinning or if you have a nucleation system by just going through subloops and seeing if the noise had to change in the cutoff as you ring down the field. If it does, then you probably have a system with nucleation of domains, and if it doesn't, you probably have domain wall motion, just a single, you're just moving a single domain wall back and forth. So that might be useful. Okay, so now back to the question, how big is this universality class? And this ties now a little bit into this question about glassy dynamics. I'm not really talking about glassy dynamics yet, but just this question of changing the dynamics, how far does that get you away from this universality class? And so one thing you might ask is, what about looking at the demagnetization curve? So people in the past have often demagnetized samples by using a ring down field. And the idea was that by ringing down the field, you might be able to get your system closer to the ground state. Yep.
The real magnet, is it possible that both the mechanisms happen at the same time? That you have
Yes. So even in our nucleation model, we do have both. I mean, we have, we can have a domain wall propagation. You know, some pre-existing clusters may grow in a next avalanche. But the difference is we also allow new domains to nucleate so that we get an interaction of many interfaces. That's the key thing. While in the domain wall motion model, we don't have an interaction of many interfaces. There's just one interface, and only that one interface moves back and forth.
Then how do you distinguish? I mean, this won't be clean anymore.
I'm sorry? How do you?
If you do this ringing down.
Yes.
And both the things are happening at the same time, then can you distinguish?
Oh, okay. So the only thing I can you can tell from this is whether you have nucleation or not.
Okay.
So that's what I mean. Yeah. You can only tell whether your moving domain walls get disturbed by other nucleated domains. Yeah, good point. Otherwise, there's not much more. Yeah. Okay, so now back to changing the dynamics. So you might ask, okay, what if I demagnetize my sample, and then I have my demagnetized state, and then I raise, so I ring down the field, I end up at my demagnetized state here in the middle, and now I raise the field up to saturation again, and I measure the avalanche size distribution on this demagnetization curve, which is really the curve that connects all these concentric subloops. So this is a different dynamics than when you drive your system through the saturation loop. John Carpenter, who was a student in our group, he did that and did it at different disorders. And you see down here the avalanche size distribution at different disorders, starting from the demagnetized state, raising the field. And he finds exactly the same exponents and exactly the same scaling collapse functions as for the saturation curve. So we think that the demagnetization curve and the saturation loop curve are in the same universality class. Now comes this next step, which I think will be interesting also in the connection to glasses. So just to remind you, we're saying glasses are stuck in metastable states and crackling noise. You drive them between metastable states, and we're asking how closely connected are those. So the random field Ising model is known to have a glassy regime, but we didn't really study that glassy regime. Instead, what we did is the following. Here is a plot of the different exponents, universal exponents. Nu is a correlation-length exponent, beta and beta delta are related to the shape of the magnetization curve, and this is from the correlation function and so on. What you see here is, on this plot here, you see hysteresis curves at different disorders, right? The one with the jump is at low disorder, the smooth one is high disorder. So these are hysteresis loops as you tune through the non-equilibrium critical point. And the red dots over here are values for the critical exponents of this non-equilibrium critical point. From different groups. This is Olga Perkovich and Eduardo Vives, and they have overlapping error bars. Great. Down here in green, you see the corresponding exponents associated with the equilibrium curve as measured by different groups. The equilibrium curve, in equilibrium, you can ask the same question: how does the magnetization change with magnetic field? At low disorder, you have a ferromagnetic phase, so your magnetization curve will have a jump. At high disorder, you have a smooth curve, and in between, there is this critical disorder with scaling. So early on, there were several groups, Vives and also Meriton and Banavar first, they suggested, wow, look at these exponents. They seem to have overlapping error bars. Could they be the same universality class? And we were always saying, there's no way. This is completely different dynamics. Why on earth should they be the same? But then when you look at this, this is quite compelling. So you start wondering, is there something to this? And then, on top of that, they have the same mean field theory exponents. So they have about the same simulation exponents in 3D and 4D. They have actually, in equilibrium and non-equilibrium, the same 6 minus epsilon expansion to all orders in epsilon. But there were always some questions about the equilibrium expansion, so we weren't. We always thought they could be non-perturbative corrections. So we thought, you know, this doesn't really mean the exponents have to be the same. But then, there's also this no passing rule that flipped spins don't flip back as you increase the field, which you have both in equilibrium and the zero temperature non-equilibrium curve. All right, so this looks pretty good. So as the strongest argument is probably from the RG that they should be the same. But then Yang said, well, let's actually test this. So Yang Liu, who recently graduated, he said, why don't we just calculate the ground state exactly for the random fieldizing model and then raise the field and just look at changes in the ground state of the system. And we're going to raise the field so slowly that we can actually look at these changes individually. So he did that. He calculated the ground state exactly. So that basically, and then you find, if you do that, that if you have your M versus H curve in equilibrium, you know, something which may look like this on a large scale, when you look closely, actually the ground state also evolves and jumps as a function of field. And each of these jumps corresponds to a connected region that flips as you raised, as you now go to the new ground state at a higher field. So then you can ask, what's the statistics of these jumps? Just like we did in non-equilibrium. And he did that for different disorders. And he found near the critical disorder at zero temperature in equilibrium. And he did these Widom scaling collapses again. And he finds the same exponents, but even more interesting, the same scaling functions as in non-equilibrium. So here is the non-equilibrium and equilibrium scaling function right on top of each other. And then he did a lot more studies. He did he studied fractal dimensions and a lot of geometrical properties of these cluster flips in the equilibrium model and compared them with the non-equilibrium, sort of anisotropies, asphericities, prolateness, and various fractal dimensions of how the surface scales with the volume and so on. And he finds for all of them pretty much overlapping error bars. So that we think the picture for the random field easing model is this. you have three different, I mean, three critical points. Again, here's field, here is disorder. You have equilibrium, you have the demagnetization curve, and you have the saturation curve. These are three different dynamics which correspond, so this is the demagnetization curve, this is non-equilibrium saturation, and in the middle here is equilibrium. And we think all these three critical points all belong to the same universality class. And there's been some very nice work by Rodriguez and others that seems to mesh with this also. So this seems to be the picture that emerges. And if you wanted to prove this, maybe you could sort of say, I have a one spin flip dynamics, two spin flip, and so on, to infinite spin flip dynamics, maybe to prove that they should be the same. So far as I know, there is no proof. There's only the renization group that seems to hint at this. And it would be interesting if there's other systems where you have equilibrium and non-equilibrium to be along to the same universality class. Okay, so that was all I was going to say on the magnets. Now let's switch to the plasticity. So recently there were some very nice experiments on sheared crystals where they measured acoustic emission and they got the spiky behavior, which is very much like the Barkhausen noise. Down here is a stress-strain curve from Demiduk's science paper in 2006 where they I'll show you the picture in the next slide. They had like these columnar nickel crystals and they were compressing them. And they were measuring the stress strain curve and they get these jumps in the stress strain curve. And then they did histograms of these jumps and they see a power law over a couple decades with an exponent of 1.5. And that exponent seems to be universal, the same for lots of different materials. And the question there was, why is this? So here is a picture of these columns that they were compressing, and here's again the stress strain curve. And early on, Miguel and Zapieri suggested, could this be connected to the magnetization curves in the Barkhausen noise picture, where a jump in magnetization is sort of the analog to a jump in strain here. So this is a picture from a domain wall motion of a magnet. And so there are some very nice simulations on these crystals. So the idea is you apply a shear stress, and when you do that, you have dislocations, edge dislocations, that move through the crystal as it deforms under this applied shear stress. So there's several groups that did dislocation dynamics. Here's a picture from Carmen Miguel's simulations where they have edge dislocations that are into the page, straight edge dislocations, and then you shear it. And each of these dots corresponds to a dislocation. If you look close up, she tells you which sign the Burgers vector is. And then you see under shear these dislocations move, and every now and then you can even see how they annihilate. So this is looping through. So I think over here, yeah, there is, for example, an annihilation event as opposite signs meet and annihilate.
Drops in there are just places where there are no dislocations, and I see one where a dislocation sort of, or maybe a dislocation pair is creeping across it.
This is a stress field. What they put in here in color, and yes, they have sometimes they have.
I see there are dots, and then there's some sort of. Measure of the stress field too.
Exactly. So they give you this.
Okay, am I right, Lucara, that these dislocations now are forming, they're clustering?
Yes, so you're starting to form walls. That's exactly right. That actually leads to the pinning in the system, that you the disorder that you generate. That's exactly right. And when you drive it very slowly, this pinning actually leads to having these avalanches. That's exactly right. Georgios Sakinis in our group has studied this also, and so we're basically, on the one hand, doing simulations. I'll show you some of his results a little later. And then there's some nice works by Pak Chen and Nigel Goldenfeld, where they also did phase field crystal simulations of the same idea, and it seems to give the same results. And then there are other groups that do phase field models, Kozlowski. So basically, there are lots of numerical approaches to this dislocation system, which are very helpful and very interesting. Now, from the magnet model, though, we found that sometimes you can write down very simple analytical models to get an intuition for what's going on. And so that's what we tried, mostly actually to guide our ideas about the simulations. And it turns out, actually, with very few inputs, you can write down this extremely simple model. It's a simple discrete model. This is this work with Yehuda Ben Zion and Jonathan Yule, where you write down a simple discrete model which has only one tuning parameter, which we call the weakening. And even though it's so simple, it seems to give exact analytical scaling predictions for two different boundary conditions, fixed stress or fixed strain, boundary strain. And the results of this are you get the same scaling exponents and functions as for the magnet interface pinning model, because they have basically the same mean field theory scaling behavior. And you get the same mean field theory as for a simple earthquake model developed by Yehuda Ben Zion and Jim Rice. So this is basically building on this model from Yehuda and Jim Rice. So basically, we're not claiming that this can do everything for you. We're just saying it's helpful to get intuition, and it's apparently it can give you the right scaling behavior. There's a lot of things like failure, stress, and so on that it can't yield stress. These non-universal quantities it cannot predict, but the universal properties seem to work. And so here's the model. It's extremely simple and related to several other models, and I'll point out the connection. So the idea is you have here your material, you're shearing it, and you're saying, what I'm gonna look at is I'm gonna have weak spots in the material that can fail if the stress is bigger than some threshold stress. So this is very much like the model that Damien was talking about. It's not quite the same, but I think they're in the same universality class. And then, so basically we have, at each point, we have a failure stress, and a point in the system is stuck until the stress gets bigger than the failure stress, then it fails until that stress at that location is reduced back to the arrest stress. So if you write down an equation of motion for the slip velocity at each point, then that's given by the applied stress plus the interaction of what else is going on in the sample, slips elsewhere, plus this pinning stress. This is actually the original earthquake model that Yehuda Ben Zion and Jim Rice wrote down, where they just focused on a single fault. But now we just say, let's just generalize it and just let it allow slip anywhere in the system. This is quite similar in the simple version to a model that Bakchen and Obukhov had in 1991, where they were simulating the situation where you had basically local failure thresholds. Now, this is the simplest version of the model, and that will give you Paola distribution of avalanche slips, as you'll see. But then you can say, now comes this one tuning parameter that I was talking about. You can say, well, what if in addition to this, you say, I also have some weakening. If after a cell slips, the failure threshold weakens down to a lower value and stays at that lower value until the avalanche is finished and then it reheals back to the old value. That would be a weakening parameter. Or you could also say, what if I allow that failure threshold to strengthen? That will lead to hardening. I'll show you that in a minute. So this, unfortunately, for historical reasons, I really should use a different symbol. We call this parameter epsilon, but this has nothing to do with strain. So we should really call it something else. But that's the weakening parameter in this model. You can, but in the simplest version right now, we say as soon as an avalanche is finished, it goes right back up to the, because we're saying if you drive it extremely slowly, it has enough time to real heal back before you trigger the next one.
If it's continuous equations, how do you ever stop?
So basically, okay, in the simulation, you can discretize it, and eventually, basically, in the simulation, you just have a discrete situation where you stop after all your stresses are below this failure stress. At that point, an avalanche stops, and then you have to raise your field before the next happens again. And then the interaction, if you think, for example, of the dislocations, although this is not just supposed to be a dislocation model, it's more like for just slips, it could be slips in other situations too. But in dislocations, for example, when they slip, you have this interaction between local slips, which drops off as 1 over r squared. And then by just power counting, you would argue that this 1 over r squared is so long range that you would expect mean field theory to give you exact results in the physical dimension, sort of in three dimensions. So for the scaling exponents, only for those. So that would be very powerful because it would mean you can just solve this in mean field theory and get the right scaling exponents.
Just to clarify, make sure I understand.
Yeah.
So you said the avalanche would stop when everything gets below the failure strength.
Exactly.
You have to get below the failure strength and or below the weakened failure strength.
You're absolutely right. So if it already slipped, then it has to go below its own failure strength, which could be the weakened value. That's exactly right. So whatever its failure strength was, during that avalanche, that's right.
But if the dynamics are just relaxational dynamics,
right?
How does it ever overshoot that threshold? Shouldn't it just exponentially approach the static state, so you'd have to use some threshold to terminate?
Yeah, but it gets reloaded by other failures in the system. So it fails, but then then you have stress redistribution to other cells. It can trigger another cell to fail.
So the cells have continuous or discrete variables. Each cell is just a discrete.
So your amount of slip is continuous. It can be any amount of slip. So basically, the amount of slip is directly proportional to the stress drop at that point. Is that what you're asking? No. So I'm basically saying, think of just a discrete case right now. You have a bunch of points in your system. Each of them here, this is your stress. As you load the system at each point, the stress gets bigger than some failure stress. It slips until it goes down to your rest stress, redistributes the stress to the other cells in the system. And then they can fail, and that failure can reload that cell to reach again a failure threshold, and then it can fail again. Does that make sense?
One of these failures is a discrete time event.
Yes, 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 okay, yes, that's right. Yep.
There's a, in the continuum mechanics, you basically have a background. For example, one thing in this picture is that you should have a, you have interaction term.
Yes.
So that part comes into the when you have a sleep, whatever sleep event, you cause the environment to change.
Right.
So in continuum mechanics, we worry this is a back to stress, which actually is stress, that's actually stress that caused this interactions. So in this system, do you have that into built into the system? So every time you have event happening, you cause the environment to change that play something to react to your future event?
Right, so every time you have a fails slipping, it changes the, we don't have sort of an elastic deformation on top of this discrete plastic deformation. So every time a cell slips, all we keep track of is the stress that gets redistributed to the other cells, and that reloads the other cells.
You modify the background.
So you.
It's a loop, consistent loop. I mean, every
yes.
time you create something, you modify the environment.
You mean the stress?
Basically, elastic modeling, I put it a simple way. right? Every time you create a defect somewhere else, this defect will fill the environment that contains other defects that modify the background. You go back and forth with loops.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if that loop is built into this model.
Yes, absolutely. You have to loop through it so many times until you reach a stable state again. And it doesn't matter in which order you update it. So it should, in the mean field theory, it gives you the same result either way. I can show you if you, you know, we can go through the details, but I can show you.
Okay,
yeah, yeah. So right now let me focus on the simplest case where you don't have that weakening. Okay, so I said this is the one tuning parameter. You can introduce the weakening during a failure threshold and that gets healed back at the end. Or you can also introduce some strengthening if you have a failure that the threshold everywhere else gets strengthened by a certain amount during that avalanche. Every time you have a failure. That is actually sort of analogous to introducing some hardening in the model. But right now, let's just say we just set this parameter to zero so that we just have this fixed threshold. And that, I think, is the mean field version of the model that Damien was presenting a couple weeks ago. He actually assigns this threshold newly every time step, but you can show in the mean field theory it makes no difference, and I think in reality it wouldn't either for the statistical properties. So if you just have that, then you can just calculate in mean field theory your stress strain curves. And they look like this. Basically, you approach a yield point where your system starts to basically depin. It's really a depinning transition. And then you can cut this in, bin this in stress, calculate the avalanche size distribution as a function of stress. And at the yield point, you get just before the yield point, you get a power law distribution of avalanche size distributions. And if you go further away from the yield point, you get a cutoff that shrinks as you go further away from this depinning point or yield point. And then with this dynamics, where you have basically just like in the spin model, you have this discrete time step, and each time step the unstable sides fail, you can also create time series of slipping events, and then you can calculate the power spectrum of these time series. And you can solve this analytically, and in mean field theory expect it to decay as omega to the minus 2. And then you have a low frequency cutoff as you're far away from the yield point, and that low frequency cutoff shrinks as you get closer and closer to the yield point. And then we know how this low frequency cutoff scales with distance from the yield point with that exponent. So the idea is, just here one more time, that as you approach this point, you really have deformation anywhere in the sample. In mean field theory, you really don't have a concept of space, but there is nothing special about any point in the sample. So you expect uniform deformation throughout the sample. But then if you introduce the weakening into the mean field theory, then what happens is, you get precursors, again, small slip events, all the way till you reach a critical failure stress where you get actually a system-spanning event. So we think in a simulation that would amount to having localization of slip, where you actually break through. And that corresponds to driving your system from a continuous depinning transition to having a depinning with hysteresis in it. So this would be where suddenly you have a first-order depinning transition with a jump. That's basically what your weakening parameter does. And then you can calculate the avalanche size distribution of the precursors. It will also decay as size to the minus 1.5, just like in this case. But then you will have a cutoff that scales like 1 over the weakening squared. So we think this is sort of a very simple version of a model for brittle failure. If you have the hardening, where you say each time a cell fails, the threshold is increased everywhere else, in that case, you get hardening behavior, where your stress strain curve looks like this, where you get hardening. The slope here scales with this hardening coefficient, like you would expect, and you get for your size distribution minus 1.5 for the power spectra of the noise train, omega to the minus 2, and for the duration, avalanche duration distribution, you get t to the minus 2. So this seems to agree with these experiments where you had s to the minus 1.5 here for your size distribution. But we would love to compare a lot more scaling quantities to experiments. So there's a lot more that the model gives you very quickly. Georgios has been working on comparing to the simulations, and so far it seems to work pretty well. So let me just summarize this simple model. You have, for slowly increasing stress boundary conditions, you have these three cases where you have weakening, and it looks like brittle behavior with first a few precursors and then brittle failure. And then you have, at no weakening, you get this smooth depinning transition that is in the same universality class as the magnetic domain wall interface depinning, and it seems to match the experiments also on the dislocation slips. And then if you introduce hardening, then it behaves like a hardening experiment with a coefficient that scales linearly with a hardening coefficient. And I'll come to scaling functions in a minute. Now, for slow tangential velocity boundary conditions, so if you impose a shear rate rather than fixed stress, then you have boundary conditions like you would expect in earthquake models. And in that case, this reduces to the simple model from Yehuda Ben Zion and Jim Rice.
Just go back.
Yep.
In the brittle case, is it a flat flat fault?
Okay, so in the mean, we don't know, and we just done the mean field theory.
So you're just saying that's what you would expect.
Actually, to be honest, because there's disorder, and I think it depends on the disorder, because I think the disorder really would probably give you some structure to this. This is just supposed to be a cartoon, but we think it looks like. Yeah. Oh, that'd be great. That'd be excellent. Yes. Yes, that'd be great.
So I'm just a little confused because you said that once the avalanche finishes, everything gets reset. Right after the event is over.
Yes.
So
yes.
You take the system and then you see the system spanning event.
Yes.
And you continue to strain the system.
Yes.
So at that point, it would go up again, or it would continue to flow along
the way? They're permanently weakened.
Well, okay, it depends how you drive it. So if you drive it at, if you were going to drive it at fixed stress, at the point where it fails, you know, it's just depinned, so it just keeps sliding. So it's sort of like if you have a depinning transition, right? Here is the sliding velocity, and here's your applied force. You know, without the weakening, you have a continuous transition. But when you introduce the weakening, what happens is you jump up to the finite sliding velocity at a critical force when you have the weakening. The first order depinning transition, it just keeps sliding because you keep your force fixed.
But if you slide at constant strain rate?
Okay, so constant, right, so exactly. If you use a very slow strain rate like in the earthquake model, then when you have the weakening, what happens is, this is sort of like driving it sort of with a soft spring. What happens is you get a big event, the big event relaxes the stress, and then you have to reload it again. So you basically have precursor again, a big event, and then again small events, and you're building up again, and then a big event. So basically, your avalanche size distribution in that case would look like this, where you have a bump out here, which are these almost periodically recurring large events with a few small precursors.
And are those then all correlated with each other, or they're decorrelated from each other?
There is no reason that they would always happen in the same spot, yes. I mean, in the mean, we really should do a simulation in finite dimensions of this. It would basically be like introducing a weakening in Damien's model. But we haven't done that. So far, we've just solved the mean field analytically. Yeah. But that's a good point. So we actually think that there's no reason why it should always be the same space, so it could, spots, it could be different places. Yeah. Yep.
One quick question, this magic epsilon parameter, is this a threshold you put into your model? Basically, like you said, if you go beyond it, that's it, and you have sort of a some sort of parameter you put into your model, or it is self-consistently coming up from your own model?
So no, so this is basically the it's the amount by which you weaken a threshold after failure. So it's sort of like, you can think of it, roughly speaking, like an analog to static versus dynamic friction. That's very loosely speaking. But that you're saying, once something slips, you know, I'm going to reduce my failure threshold by this weakening parameter, and I keep it lower so that basically once it slips, it's easier to keep slipping during the same avalanche until the avalanche finishes. And then it becomes stronger again. So it's basically the amount of weakening that you get during slip, during an event.
So that's the fixed parameter you put it in.
That's exactly. That's a fixed parameter that we
put
in.
Me of, for some reason, numerical work in glass field, what they did is very simple. They didn't go through these loops. They basically did is that you actually distribute regions with a different shear model. You have a variation Gaussian distribution of different elastic moduli, and then you shear it, you find the similar localization event and all those nice, if you call it, avalanches. So that's another way to do it. You just put into a parameter that's fixed.
Okay.
Go ahead and drive it.
Oh, that, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, if you're shear modulus, if it's quenched, if it doesn't change dynamically with time, it'd be interesting to see. I would expect.
Is this parameter self-consistently sort of evaluated every during the drive, or is it put in something? You just put the threshold there.
It's put in, but it has a dynamic meaning because we're saying it just tells you by how much you have to reduce the threshold after a failure, and after the end of an avalanche, the failure strength gets set back up to the original value. So basically, we're saying that our failure thresholds change with time, and that is crucial for getting these large runaway events. So that's why I'm thinking I would naively, I don't know, we haven't checked it, but naively I'd expect if you just change basically your modulus and have it quench and not change with time, I wouldn't think that it gives you the same effect. Because we always thought we need this dynamic weakening in order to reduce these runaway events. Because actually just having your modulus change in space sounds to me a lot like random bonds, and we would expect, you know, you just get the same behavior as we had with no weakening. But I'm just saying this, it's just a guess, I don't know, we haven't checked that. All right, so basically the whole idea is, you know, the question is, if you have dynamic weakening, then you get these big runaway events, and if you don't, you don't get them. And for the earthquake boundary conditions, where you have fixed strain boundary conditions, then you get, with no weakening, where you always have the same failure threshold, you get power law distribution of earthquakes, which is called Gutenberg-Richter distribution, while if you have this weakening, then you get the characteristic earthquake distribution. And you can actually also get mode switching in that case, in under certain conditions, where for a while you get these big runaway events, and then suddenly it switches over into other behavior. But in order to get the mode switching, you need to, there's more behind. You need to actually also, there's another parameter. You have to have reduced stress transfer. So right now, I'll just leave this out. If you're interested, I can tell you how to get that. But if in the version I talked about so far, you just get this distribution where you have small precursors and then these almost periodically recurring large runaway events with the weakening. And with the hardening, you get, again, power law with the cutoff that's given by how much you harden your system. And then if you can also get a model with aftershocks. If you say your hardened thresholds weaken down with time, that can lead to aftershocks. So that would be a mechanism there to describe it. But actually, what I'm more interested in to ask for input hear from you is, what about universal scaling functions? Remember this avalanche profile that we talked about earlier, which is basically the slip rate as a function of time for these individual avalanches. In this mean field theory, again, it's a parabola because it's the same mean field theory as the domain interface depending mean field theory. Georgia Sikinis recently did a simulation of these slip avalanches in the dislocation model using dislocation dynamics for these edge dislocations as he shears the system, and he measured this profile. And he finds something, this black curve is again the parabola, and his simulations fall pretty well on top of that. And he's right now doing larger systems to get even better statistics, but we were quite happy to see that this seems to match pretty well. And the exponents also match the mean field theory. So this is very encouraging. However, let me tell you, in real earthquakes, if you measure the same slip velocity as a function of time, the same function, here is the parabola, and in real earthquakes, you get this asymmetry, which is very much like in the magnets, and there's still a debate for why this is, and it would be incredibly nice to get better data on, I mean, more data for small earthquakes to get better statistics. Yep.
In terms of, you're almost done, go ahead and finish.
I'm sorry.
I guess if you wanted us, as the people in the GLASS community, to try to do these, there's a question as to how big an event, how many particles would need to be involved before you would expect to be in the scaling regime. Because I would expect that one of these avalanches would have this universal shape only if it was bigger than some size, like not three atoms popping, but 30. So
what I would say is look at your avalanche size distribution, and then if you get a power law, and so I think any events that fall nicely within the power law scaling regime should show this. That's what we're. That's how we did it in the simulations also. So basically, you have, because that tells you that you're in the scaling regime when your avalanche sizes are well within the power law range.
It may not be so simple, but...
Yeah.
But normally when you do these sort of spin systems, then things have to be fairly big before you cross over to the large scale shape, right? There's normally, certainly, linear dimensions bigger than 3 or something are going to be needed before things are going to scale.
Right.
And some of what we've seen would suggest that a lot of the events are smaller than that. So I'm wondering if some of the things we heard about yesterday would be hard to map into this picture just because the events are so small.
Okay. I mean, really, strictly speaking, this is only a prediction for the large events because it's in the scaling regime. So ideally, I would say if you can go to the largest possible events that are still small enough not to be obscured by finite size effects. Maybe that's a better because it should, it, yeah, I mean, as soon as you, yeah, it's really the large limit. Scaling limit. But that would be incredibly interesting to see. We would really be very interested in what that would look like.
You're looking at these in these dislocation models or in the random field sizing models? Or where is this data coming from?
So we've looked at them in both. So yeah, so this is the shape in the dislocation model. So this is really from simulations of a bunch of dislocations that Giorgio set up, very much like Miguel's simulation. And then he sheared it and he measured the slip velocity and did a scaling collapse for avalanches of different times, and he got this.
But yep. So those times, since each unit time is sort of flipping one shell of neighbors, this could be quite a large event, at least 20 or 30 spins.
Well, this is not spins. This is real dislocations. So this is...
20 or 30, okay.
This is quite, yeah, this was well within, so he had a power law distribution of slips of avalanches, and it was sort of like towards the large end of his power law distribution, but in a range where he knew he was smaller than the finite size effects. That was actually important, because finite size effects in these dislocation systems are huge. because of the long-range interactions, yeah.
One quick question. I remember James did something in 2D. Is this a 2D dislocation model?
So this is, yeah, this is 2D really, because we have straight edge dislocations.
Right.
But there is Zeiser and collaborators did a simulation in 3D, and they didn't calculate this specific function, but they calculated scaling exponents, and they get the same as 2D. And that is what we would also expect if this reionization group argument applies, because we have long-range interactions, and so if we say it should be right in 2D, mean field theory should be right in 2D, it should be even more right in 3D, you know, because as you go to higher dimensions, mean field theory always works, you know, better. So basically, the argument is 2 and 3 in higher dimensions, they should all be scaling mean field-like because of the long-range interaction.
There's an interesting thing in 3D, maybe in general for these locations, you have this strong anisotropy comes in.
Right.
So basically, all those models, you assume a very generic sort of a square lattice or something. But in crystal case, the elasticity is anisotropic. That caused a lot of things to change dramatically.
True.
Maybe mean field theory will work out because you averaged everything, but we don't know.
I'm only saying that the mean field theory will work for the scaling exponents, so for the avalanche size distribution scaling exponent. So you're absolutely right, there will be lots of things that are completely different in 3D, but the universal behavior, we think, is the same. At least that's what Zeiser also found in his simulation. He gets the same scaling exponents for the full 3D simulations. Yeah.
And to measure size of events in the dislocation systems there, you're looking at how many dislocations moved, or how do you...
Right. So it's the equivalent of a moment in an earthquake, which would be like the total slip during an... Yeah, that's right. There are several different measures. Sometimes people measure the total energy dissipated during an earthquake, but it amounts to, you can work out which quantities of those are equivalent. So Georgios used the total slip in
what happens if you have a screen as a elementary excitation? Would that change your picture?
Right, that'll be next. That's right. So actually I should just make one quick comment. We have actually looked a little bit, we asked a little bit the question, what about granular materials? And we were motivated by the fact that the exponents that people find are quite similar. So we basically, I should really stop, I'm running, and I can tell you offline a little bit more. We introduced a new parameter that's like the packing fraction in this mean field model, and then get avalanche predictions as a function of packing fraction in the models. So these are predictions that we would like to compare, and the prediction for the scaling function from this mean field theory amounts to the same thing again. And recently, Karen Daniels gave a talk at the APS meeting where she did experiments on granular slips and measured this and got something that looks just like a parabola also. And she gets exponents that match with our mean field theory. So this sounds encouraging, but this is work in progress. So let me just summarize here real quick. We talked about this nucleation universality class, where you know, that's pretty big. And then the domain wall mean field theories seem to include magnetic domain walls, plasticity, likely granular materials, and then the earthquake models. I mean, these are very simple models for these cases. And we'd love to see more tests in comparison with experiments and simulations. So thank you very much. Yep?
If you go back to the magnetic case.
The
case of magnets.
Yes.
What is known about the role of temperature and finite sweep rate?
Yes, thank you very much. If you have finite sweep rate, then you get, basically, if you sweep faster, what happens is you get, you can get overlaps of avalanches. You know, that a new avalanche starts before an old one finishes. And Robert White, who was a student in our group, he studied this in detail, and he finds that if you sweep very slowly, All right, nothing changes. As you get faster, that you have overlaps in time, but not in space. So basically that you have an avalanche happening, basically what I'm trying to say is, you have an avalanche happening and another one starting before the previous one ends. Then to an experimentalist, this looks, if they just can't see this and you just have a signal, this looks like one avalanche. And you can ask, does this change my avalanche statistics? And the answer is, only if your duration exponent is -2, and your avalanche duration exponent is -2, then adding this type of finite sweep rate effect will actually make this exponent change linearly with the sweep rate, which is very odd, but you can show this analytically. But if you had, if your system had any other exponent than 2, then having this overlap in the avalanches will not change your avalanche exponent at all. And it will not change your power spectra either, until you sweep so fast that you start a new avalanche in the same volume where the old avalanche wanted to propagate, so that you get basically parallel processing of avalanches. In that case, then you also start to see changes in the power spectra. So you can systematically study that. And then for your finite temperature question, yep.
So in that limit too, when you get to those higher rates you're talking about, then in the interface model, you get a changing of the self-affine scaling exponent. There's a crossover length in that model, right?
Yes. Where
as a function of rate, that length starts very large and goes down, and that's related to whether you're breaking up the big avalanche or not.
Very nice.
Is there anything analogous in the other model, where you don't have the interface motion, where?
Right. So.
If you look at the fractal dimension of the.
Okay.
The clusters.
Yeah. So they should change. Actually, that we have not studied. We haven't looked at the fractal dimension. But we have looked at the power spectra, and we see a change in the power spectra because you have interaction. But for sure, you'd be right, because you change the shape of the avalanches now because they process too fast. Yeah, that's actually a very good question. We should look at that. But I'm sure you would find that too. And then at finite temperature, actually, it's very interesting. As you introduce finite temperature, it becomes important how fast do you drive your system, because you have an equilibration time scale and you have a driving time scale, and the question which is faster. So basically, as you increase the temperature, you expect your hysteresis loops to shrink at fixed driving rate, because you're approaching equilibrium at higher temperature. So basically, we have a scaling rate theory that sort of suggests that, out here, this will be your equilibrium behavior. In the middle, this will still be your non-equilibrium hysteresis loop, which on long length scale is going to be described by the zero temperature fixed point. But I think in experiment, it'll be interesting to look at power spectra. Sort of, the finite temperature will give you changes in the power spectra at high frequencies because of the jiggling due to temperature. And so we did that in the model, and so there are some predictions for how this behaves as a function of temperature and so on. But
so this is the spectrum of the whole signal or from the individual avalanche?
Either one. So basically, at finite temperature, you get your noisy signal, and then it becomes more unclear where's an avalanche, where's noise. So basically, you just take that noise train and do the power spectra of that. And that should show high frequency deviations. So we expect at low frequencies to still see the power spectra of the zero temperature behavior, but at high frequencies, we expect to see this noise from the temperature. And that would be very, very interesting to see in other systems as well, in the plasticity or even in magnets compared to experiments. We haven't seen much on that. Yep.
Is it a similar phenomenology with temperature, that you go from large discontinuous system spanning events to a critical point to continuous?
So we think what's happening is, in the scaling theory at least, that basically you will have, the tails out here will be your equilibrium behavior, but here in the middle, you will still have your little hysteresis loop, which will still, as you change this order, will still be going through that phase transition. Because the reason is, here in the middle, the barriers to equilibration are huge. So in the limit of taking driving rate to zero and temperature to zero, we think this will be your equilibrium tails, and here is the non-equilibrium critical behavior in the middle. But the nice thing is, because they belong to the same universality class anyways, there's not really much of a conflict here. So, yeah, that's sort of the picture we have. Other questions?
Well, thank you.
Thank you.